Welcome to Out There with TJ Ryan. It's strange. It's unusual. It's mysterious. It's out there, out there, out there, out there. And now your host, TJ Ryan.
You've heard me talk about the Hollow Earth before. Rodney Clough was a guest on my show, and I've always been fascinated by this subject. I read a book years ago that, I don't know, I thought was really, really cool, and it looked at a lot of prior experiences people had, going back to the 1800s, a pretty well-known group of a couple of fishermen went to, they claimed the Hollow Earth, and then there's been others that have had stories about it, so you wonder if it's a possibility. Well, now, this week, I have somebody who is part of an expedition. His name is Dr. Brooks Agnew, and there's an expedition that's going in 2013. Dr. Agnew is with me right now. Brooks, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing fine. Good to be part of the program today.
You are set to take this journey. Now, first of all, if you could give me a little background on yourself, where you're from and how you grew up and why you came to believe the earth was hollow, if you don't mind telling me.
Sure. I grew up in California, went in the Air Force in 1973, studied electronics and physics there, got out, went to college, ended up getting a degree in chemistry and biology, and later a master's in statistics, and finished a PhD in physics a number of years ago. So I got interested in the hollow earth because my co-author and I had written a series of books called The Ark of Millions of Years, which was about the origin and destiny of the earth. And one of the legends that came out as we were studying all these ancient civilizations and trying to relate them to modern physics was that earth might be hollow. I found that fascinating, read a couple books on it, thought they were a little out there and sort of shelved the idea. But over the next few years, between 2001 and 2005, enough evidence popped up that called into question the current viewpoint of planetary core geology. So I said, well, gee, somebody's done an expedition up there. Let's see what information is available. Well, there wasn't any. So I started doing research on expeditions, and I found Rodney Clough and his group, which then was run by Stephen Curry. I joined the group as a part of the team to build the gyroscope to measure Earth's curvature so that we'd know when we sail into an opening or a oceanic depression, should there be one. And in August of 2006, learned that a couple months before, Stephen Curry had tragically died of rapid onset brain cancer. I just met the guy in the previous November.
That's what I saw on the internet. Remember I was telling you, Brooks, that I saw there was a fellow that was leading the expedition, and then there was an unexpected death. Stephen Curry, that's the fellow I saw, yep.
Oh, okay. So a couple months later, I guess it was in early October, they elected me to be the new expedition leader. And so obviously 2007 was out of the question because it takes several months to raise the money for a venture like this. So we started in earnest right then for 2008, and it looked like we had a production company. We'd met with several groups that had done very successful documentaries for the Discovery Channel and History Channel. And of course, you know, we had the world's worst economy in 2008, so it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So we shot for 2009, and then 2010, and then 2011, and every time we got close to the money, it just mysteriously evaporated, you know, into ghost land. So Now we finally have a Park Avenue, New York production company, and investment company that has stepped forward and pledged the funds. So we're about to make the deposit on the ship, and when we do, we'll make another global announcement that it's game on for the expedition. So in the meantime, we've built international support. We've published a pilot film, which was viewed by 17 million people in one night. We have attracted support from Harvard, MIT, Stanford University, Washington University. Several universities have written opinion papers and very favorable on the theory. And for the record, I don't believe in hollow earth theory.
Really?
I'm a scientist, and belief is not part of the equation for me. I'm a scientist and I'm looking for evidence. I'm looking for to conduct experiments to prove or disprove the hypothesis that planets form as hollow spheres. I think it's interesting, I think it's fascinating, and also deplorable that science has never fully investigated this question.
Do you think that science doesn't investigate it because maybe there are some egos involved and they don't want the possibility? I mean, we've looked at many things in our scientific culture, and it seems like, you know, sometimes you're dealing with, it's hard to buck the trend. Let's put it that way.
I think the answer is no. I think the primary reason that science has not investigated this is twofold. One is it's very expensive, and scientists are poor as church mice. The second is there's no hope in developing a weapon. If there was hope in developing a weapon, we would have had the money the first year. Look at the money that we've poured into CERN.
Yeah.
You think we really want to understand the origin of the universe? No. We want to build a better weapon. Mm-hmm. That's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. So if it was something that they could see a gain, then they might be all over it. So your expedition, you're going to be aboard an icebreaker.
That's correct. This is above the 86th parallel, which in this particular region of the ocean has never been sailed before, ever. It's been flown over a few times, and maybe the U.S. military has sailed through it by submarine. But this area has been covered by ice for over 200,000 years and only opened up in 2007 when there was what we call in Arctic terminology, calving. It's sort of, you know, when a cow gives a calf. When the ice calves, it breaks off a huge part of itself, which floats off, and sometimes it refreezes in another part, and sometimes it just floats out to sea. This one was about the size of the state of Connecticut.
Hmm. Wow. And so being able to get this ship, you were telling me, is what cost you a lot of money. That's a couple million just to use the ship, right?
That's correct. The ship has 150-man crew. It is a former Soviet vessel. It's now operated by a private shipping company in Russia. And they charter it out for tours. And it makes 4 to 6 tours a year, two of them or three of them in the Arctic and two or three of them in the Antarctic, depending on money and weather and availability. And so we're chartering this ship to take it to an area that it's never been before, and they're excited about it. They've actually given us a special price and all kinds of special participation with their scientists and crew. Yeah, they're in full support of it. They want to do it too.
Dr. Agnew, why did not maybe take a plane and try to go and find this opening?
Well, it was done once in 1926 by Admiral Byrd, and the rumors abound about what he saw, and what he witnessed, what he reported on. But it hasn't been done since because he did it at 2,500 feet, which is why he's an aviation hero and not a statistic. But we've tried numerous times to charter aircraft to make this venture, and the lowest that they will fly is 17,500 feet, which all you're going to see is clouds. Mm. You won't see anything at that altitude. So we just decided not to do it because it was expensive and we wouldn't see anything.
If you find this opening, do you have any belief of, I'm guessing you don't at this point because you're skeptical about it, but what do you expect to see?
Well, I'm not skeptical. I'm just a scientist, and I really do want to find whatever is there. And that being said, I have to, you know, probably criticize my genre, my fellow colleagues out there, because they regularly throw out data. They get data that doesn't fit their paradigm or doesn't fit the direction they want to take their hypothesis, and they just discard it. We obviously have decided not to do that. So when people say that there are civilizations living inside the Earth, or that there are large populations of UFOs, you know, parked on the bottom of the ocean up there because it's, you know, never visited, they're never bothered, we could throw out that data. We could say, oh, that's ridiculous, we won't prepare for that. But that's not the team we are. So we are preparing to find everything. And whatever we find, we will report.
You have 100 people on this expedition. What are the different types of professions, professional people, or just people in general that are going to be on board?
That's a good question. when Stephen was putting the venture together, he had done this before with other exotic areas. You know, they do their marketing, and people with money, you know, buy a seat for $20,000 or $25,000, and it could be done. In fact, it partially was done. All that money's since been returned to all of those individuals as good faith for the Curry effort. But we did not want to put together a venture of rich tourists. We wanted to actually make a discovery and report on it legitimately. So we went to, we published a few requests for papers out there, and we received published papers from Harvard, from MIT, from Stanford, from Washington University. And these were stunning papers, things like Washington University's paper from Dr. Y. Sessions that another ocean had been discovered underneath the Atlantic Ocean. Papers from Harvard that clearly show that Earth has a solid core counter-rotating with a solid crust. Papers from Japan that said that the core was a solid iron crystal. They even had the frequency at which it resonated. You know, papers from Stanford University on Arctic plate tectonics and the fact that MIT issued a paper saying that the Lagrange limit or Lagrange point, which is a point equidistant between the sun and Earth, is 1,200 kilometers off the center of the Earth. It's actually centered much more closely to the crust than it is the core. All of these hard data points call into question classic planetary core geology and leave the question open that planets form as hollow spheres.
And if they form as hollow spheres, then how would they be able to, I mean, is there like a central sun? I've heard stories about that. I'm guessing you don't know, but I'm throwing this out there. Is there a possibility of a central sun inside there?
Well, not in the classic sense of a fusion sun like we have at the center of our solar system, but a solid iron crystal, and this has been spectrographically measured, so we know that it's iron because of its molecular weight. But we also know that it's probably at a temperature of between 5,000 and 10,000 degrees, which means that it's glowing white hot, which also means that it would put out wavelengths of light in the visible range, not in the UV range like the sun does, but in the visible range, and could be functional with some sort of photosynthesis, which means you've got light, energy, water, and space. I can guarantee you, as a scientist, there will be life there.
What if you run into humanoid life?
Well, hopefully they're not hostile. We don't, for the record, do not plan to sail a 450-foot-long, 23,000-ton, 75,000-horsepower nuclear-powered icebreaker inside the Earth. That's not going to happen. But we will get close to the opening as we can, and there's another boat on the ship, and there's also a helicopter on the ship, and we can make excursions and explore. And the idea is, at least the way the board has decided to approach this, that if there is intelligent life inside the planet, we will invite them to come to us. And when they do, we'll get it on film, and the world will see it live.
Wasn't part of Admiral Byrd's story, and, you know, there's so many different stories out there, but that he was escorted down and he met some beings?
Well, I think the correct term would be the story about Admiral Byrd's story. You know, Admiral Byrd was a military hero, and he was an ultra-patriot. And he was also not a man of many words. He did not publish. He didn't make public speeches. He was all about setting records and about expunging the world of Nazis, which he did a good job of his entire life. There are rumors out there that he wrote a diary. There are all kinds of people that have made tons of money hawking this stuff. And we have our doubts in the veracity of that. We think that we're going to treat this as personal testimony and put it in the direct observation class of scientific data. We're not going to throw it out, obviously, but we're going to take it with a grain of salt until we have some data to back it up.
You know, if this is the case, if you do prove that there's a a hollow earth sustainable for life, then even the most barren planets could probably have potential for life if they're hollow inside as well.
In fact, if there is intelligent life throughout the universe, the chances, the odds of that life living on the exterior of a planet the way we do are very slim.
Hmm.
Most of those societies will have to live under the surface of their planets. I mean, Earth, as wonderfully beautiful and with all the variety of life that it has, is still hostile to human life. We only spend 15% of our time outdoors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got to make sure we have enough heat or enough. If we're out in the extreme heat, we can certainly dehydrate and die. So we're pretty fragile beings, aren't we?
Yeah, we you know, our nails are not made for fighting or digging. We're not particularly fast runners. We don't have body hair to protect us in the winter. We're not strong. We don't have the right kind of muscle to jump 30 times our body length in a single bound. We're not really built for this planet. We didn't come from here.
We didn't come from here. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that the DNA that makes up the human being has medically been determined to have been altered.
Hmm.
And it doesn't alter that way in nature. It was altered on purpose. So whatever being we are, whatever cross of different life forms we are on this planet, was not accidental.
And you're saying that, I guess, I don't know what you're saying exactly, Dr. Agner, you're saying that maybe somebody tampered with us along the way?
Well, it's Occam's razor. You remove all the things that that don't make sense, and the thing that's left has to be the truth.
Mm.
Genes, DNA, is an engineered molecule. It doesn't form naturally. Mm. It has to be built.
Mm.
And human gene pairs are not a multiple of any other form of life on this planet. The human genome has been mapped and remapped and compared to all kinds of other species. It does appear that some recombinant work and splicing work has been done on the human genome with genetics that are here on this planet. But that did not occur in nature.
No. So you're basically, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's one of two things. Some people might believe that God put us here and did that. Some people might say alien races. You're just kind of leaving it open?
Well, maybe it's a little of both. You know, by the time you finish the book of Genesis, you're introduced to five different races, none of whom are from here.
Mm-hmm.
So what's an alien? I think if you know, want to know who E.T. is, I guess we're E.T.
Mm. Have you ever had, now this is a little bit off it, but have you ever had any kind of experiences, unknown, strange, unusual experiences?
Well, the answer is yes, but not until I was 52 years old.
Mm.
Life was pretty textbook, pretty not routine, certainly, because I'm always pushing the envelope with respect to technology. But, yeah, in August of 2006, I don't know if I returned or if I opened a new part of me. It seems to me that I had this part back when I was 9, and it kind of went to sleep for my rest of my life, a result of indoctrination or rationalization from my parents and teachers and peers and all coworkers throughout the years. But in 2006, I was reintroduced to that that energy, that spirit, I guess you might call it. And the old me, or the original me, opened back up again, and I have I don't think I've ever been happier in my entire life.
So you're saying what you truly were at one time, which kind of, as I was just talking about this with somebody else, is that we get altered with our true feeling of who we are, of what we are, because society around us maybe doesn't, they don't want us to be that. And so as a child, that's who we truly are.
Yeah, I think you're rather unfettered when you're before what I call step in. You know, you become self-aware and realize that, hey, I guess I am affecting the universe. For some kids, that's 9. For some, it's 10. And for some, unfortunately, it never happens.
Mm.
But we somehow are coaxed into going to sleep, to realizing that what we are familiar with, being able to see through time, being able to understand motion and mathematics and relationships between different forms of energy, has to go to sleep. in order to fit into this society. Mm-hmm. So you're exactly right.
We close off to anything that's unusual. My show has been, you know, I've had a lot of strange things happen in my life. Things I can't necessarily explain, but as I talk to more people and I explore it myself, I've come to realize there's the physical senses. We can't always define everything we see. And I guess what I was asking you, have you ever had, I don't know, a UFO experience or something that you can't explain?
Yeah, I have. And as I said, that happened in 52. I'll give you some details. One of the things about science is classifying the data that comes in. And what a lot of people don't realize that a fact, the actual scientific term of a fact, is a direct observation. A direct observation can be made with your eyes, your ears, or with instruments, but it's a direct observation nonetheless. So on August 17th, 2006, I made a direct observation that opened my eyes. I saw my first UFO that night, and I will tell you that I had no small amount of fear. I looked up, and this craft was above us, lit up, changed direction, came down what I thought was close at the time, because I actually had a panic, you know, come up in my chest, like you know, like a lion just looked you in the eyes, and I realized what had happened. That I had not seen a satellite. I had seen something that was unidentified. The next day, I was reintroduced to meditation. I'd done that when I was young and then had given it up because it didn't really do for me what I wanted it to do. It was transcendental meditation, great for falling asleep or clearing your mind or eliminating the problems of the day, but not much for exploring. Mm-hmm. So I learned a new type of meditation over that weekend, and that night I was meditating, and a direct communication opened up between me and what appeared to be Mount Adams, which was 13 miles away, which I could see out the window, and there was direct communication. There was a download bunch of information.
When you say, Brooks, when you're saying Mount Adams, you said?
Yeah, Mount Adams, Washington.
You're talking about an individual in Mount Adams?
No, not an individual. I would say a community, because there were an innumerable number of voices all singing in unison like a big choir. And at the end of that, one individual spoke to me. And I recognized the words, although I didn't recognize the voice. And I changed back to who I was when I was nine. It was like a Control-Alt-Delete. All of the trappings and scripts and mirrors and blockages which I had developed throughout my life, that we all develop throughout our lives to protect ourselves, you know, psychologically from those around us, all those disappeared. And so the old patterns of being wallpaper, I suppose, a wallflower, went away. And I stepped out into the light and said, you know what, I'm really not afraid of who I am now. And I don't know how to explain this to you, but I'm a first-timer here on this planet, and many of you have been here many, many, many times and don't realize it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I didn't know we were going to get to this, Dr. Agnew. This is really cool.
Well, the interesting thing is that, believe it or not, the 40 million people or so that have become enthusiasts of the Hollow Earth, this is a common theme. There's such an emotional, spiritual bond that people feel about this expedition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a long time, I just thought, okay, we're going to sail across the water. We'll sample sea life and air and magnetism, and we'll report on it and make a great paper and maybe a good documentary. But the spiritual bond and closeness with the juxtaposition that makes up the human consciousness is just underneath the surface of this. I can't quite put my finger on it, but when people write me, it isn't, you know, hey, I'm really excited to see the documentary. No, it's like, I've dreamed of this my whole life. I've been there. People are having out-of-body experiences, and I'm the tremendous outpouring of passion that comes from thousands and thousands of people that have applied to be one of these 100 on the ship is like nothing I've ever seen.
You know, I think there's, and in a similar way too, Brooks, the same can be said, you were kind of touching on what, you know, my show touches on what some people call the metaphysical, the part we can't grasp onto, the, if you want to call it the spiritual side of it, the thought-based side of it, the connection that we all have. And I see that. I see that with this journey, this expedition. I just feel like we're all trying to find the truth. And we're coming into a time, the way I see it, is that more of these kind of things are coming forward. And maybe that's why so many people are jumping on board with this, because they just know it. And like you said, some of us have been here many times, and you're first time around. First time on the block, huh, Brooks?
Well, I think there are a lot of us here because it's not that we're uncomfortable. No. It's that we're nonconformists. We simply can't fit into the normal human society. And by the way, I really like that term, metaphysics, or paraphysics. It rises. It's not just the esotericism of thinking about the spiritual aspects of a journey like this. There is something that's above physical about this, maybe a higher dimensional or higher vibrational, because when you look at it on the surface, it looks like cold, clear data. But when you look at the total picture of it, take in all of the aspects of this, it becomes fundamental to the human race. And as I said, some people have been here many, many times. I'm sure there are people walking around the planet right now that remember the times of Egypt and Atlantis and whatever. Well, those memories are in there. They've been suppressed because of our society, and you can't just walk around today and say, hey, I used to be an Atlantean. But this is the kind of doorway, the gateway that opens all this up, where people can recall all that they have been, and since, you know, they became self-aware, which could have been millions of years ago.
You know, and I've heard many different theories as to why we maybe have forgotten or don't remember, and I'm really kind of leaning towards that there have been those that have manipulated us not to remember because they want to keep us in the dark. And it's about control. And so I see what you're doing, along with Rodney and the rest of your expedition, are those that are seeking, if you want to call it a higher truth, a greater understanding that's been hidden for so long. And we know that journeys have gone on. Who are the fishermen that wrote about their story back in the 1800s? You know who I'm talking about?
The Smoky God? Yeah, that was an interesting story, and the younger of the two, father and son team, the father was killed in an ice accident after they came out, and the son was actually allegedly picked up on the ice by a fishing crew that was down there, and he was down there with virtually no supplies, just a jacket and, you know, gloves and boots, and they said, dude, how did you get down here? You know, we're about 3,000 miles from civilization. And when he told the story about having, you know, come out of the hollow earth, you know, they sort of looked sideways at him the rest of the journey. And as soon as they got back, he promptly went to an asylum to be repatriated in those of us that know that no such thing could possibly happen.
Do you think you're going to get any pressure from world governments for what you're doing? Do you think anybody's going to try to stop you?
No, I don't think so. I think they think we're nuts, and I think that you know, an investor that sees the potential in this is going to see an opportunity, but and we have had some that we've actually turned away because they were in it for the money, they were in it for the, you know, profiting off of the franchise. The partners that we have now see the purpose of what we're trying to do. They really see a higher calling. Will it pay for itself? Who knows if it will or not, but you just got to do higher things sometimes. Scientists almost never look for profit in what they do. They just want to know. They just want to discover, and that's me. I'm the consummate explorer. Pressure from governments? I don't think so. I just don't think they care.
You don't think that if our government knew that there was or even the other governments of the world knew that there was another, inside the earth was a place where other beings could live. There's who knows what kind of minerals inside there. I mean, we know what we're after. Conquering land has always been, taking a piece of land has been the most important to governments all over the world. You don't think that they'd go after that?
Well, I do, in fact. And that's why I think that if they had the slightest inkling that this existed, and I'm sure that they've explored all up there with all kinds of military craft, including submarines. If they knew it was there, they would be bombing it, and they would be dredging it for minerals as we speak. Mm. Obviously, that's not happening. So they just don't care about this anymore. They did back in World War II, but they just don't care about it anymore.
Hmm. Well, that's good. I hope you have a great trip. I hope everything goes well for you. 2013, when are you leaving?
We're leaving the last week of July in 2013 from Murmansk, Russia. We'll be going up to Helsinki, making a stop there, and then we'll be taking off on our predetermined course. That course is posted at the website, NDIEE.org. That stands for North Pole Inner Earth Expedition.org. You can always sign up. There are still 32 seats left on the ship that we have not decided who's going to go.
Really?
And the odds are not that bad. There's only about 6,000 applications for those 32 seats.
Oh, yeah.
and we haven't started going through them yet, so some of them we will...
Does everybody have to pitch in money if you're going to want to be a part of that? Do you have to...
No, there's no money required.
Really?
Yeah, the investors have put up all the money. This will be a $23,000 grant to the person who goes.
Wow.
We're not selling seats. That would be counter to our charter. We feel that the 15 days that this thing is going to be filmed is going to be, first of all, one of the most exciting reality programs to ever watch. It's going to make Deadliest Catch look like, Gilligan's Island.
Yeah.
And second of all, there's a synergy. There's a, I don't know how to put this. The board believes that there are 100 correct people to go on this expedition. Hmm. They'll know who they are, and they'll find their way to applying at NPE.org. We'll know who they are because we just have a process of going through these names. Now, we're going to choose the core 100, and then we'll choose another 50 alternates or so because things happen between when we make this announcement of who and when and everything around November of this year and next July. People die, they get sick, they have relatives that die, they run out of money, they can't get a passport, all those things. So you got to have alternates. So there'll be 150 people that are on call, and 100 are going to go with us. But we also realize that there are 40 million other people that want to go as well. So we're going to be streaming live from the ship from the day we leave Murmansk until we return. And you can log on for, I don't know, something like 99 cents. It'll be completely affordable, but that's how we'll pay for the expedition, obviously. And that those people can watch what's going on by looking at the cameras that are on the ship, and they'll be going 24 hours a day for 15 days.
Is there any way I can call you while you're going there?
yeah, absolutely. We're going to do as many interviews as we can do.
That'd be awesome. That would be awesome. I'd like to call you. You're going to be gone for 2 weeks then?
We have 15 primary days, and the plan is for a five-day option. It means that, let's say we're up for 10 and a half days and we've reached the point of no return or the point where we have to start returning and we just make the discovery or we have 500 square miles to go. We can opt to extend for 5 days and the option funding will be there for that. And it'll depend on a lot of things. We might run into bad weather. This area of the planet has the worst oceans on the planet, and we'll see 10-story seas and 70-mile-an-hour winds and sub-freezing temperatures and icebergs. But, it's not a vacation. This is a venture.
Mm-hmm. Got to be fairly dangerous, too, I would think, right? Fairly dangerous adventure.
There will be injuries. Hopefully, if we return with less than one death, we've been successful.
Wow. And what do you have to do to get ready for that, to prepare? What do people have to do?
Well, I am recommending that people get their orders, their life in order, make sure that their life insurance policy is paid up, make sure that their family knows that they're going, and, that this is a high-risk venture, and they may step off the ship and not come back, and also that they get in shape. I usually do speed biking for at least 8 weeks for a venture like this so that I'm in shape. We don't want to get you on the boat where you have to get your sea legs and you spend, 10 of the 15 days in the head, trying to acclimate to the constant motion.
Yeah, that's
recommend that you get in shape.
That's probably, even if you are in shape and you're not used to being on a boat like that, That could be difficult the first few days at least, I would think.
Could be. And it's, you'll have to get a passport and you'll have to get your equipment to Russia, which takes about 3 months to do. They have to get it. They have to review it. They got to look at your plan. And then all that stuff gets shipped to the boat, which is about a four-hour train ride north of St. Petersburg. So this is really, really cold area.
Mm. Good thing you're going in July.
We have to go in July because the ocean begins refreezing at the end of August at the rate of about 10,000 square miles a day.
Wow. You've got a short window to get in there, maybe see what you can, and document it, and then be able to get back. And even getting back might be a little bit hairy, too, I'm thinking, right?
Well, it's a capable ship. There are only two civilian ships on the planet capable of making this venture. And one of those ships will be chartered by us. So these boats can take it. I doubt very seriously that they'll get landlocked or ice locked, but they can make it. Still, you know, crunching ice at 8 knots takes a long time to get anywhere.
Just imagine if you're able to document this and you bring back evidence. How do you think that's going to be accepted?
I think it'll be accepted on numerous planes. For instance, the world's greatest ornithologist, who is an expert in the Ross Gull. Now, the Ross Gull was named by my ancestor, Sir James Ross, who discovered the North Magnetic Pole in 1831. This is a tiny little seagull that allegedly flies north for the winter. It's not built for the winter. It can't take those kinds of temperatures. And yet, in the spring, it returns as though, none the worse for wear. So no one knows where it goes. And it's impossible to track. It's too small to carry a device. No satellites can reach wherever these birds go. So that's one level that it could be validated. The other is a unique marine life that may be near an opening like that. Different sea chemistry, different magnetism or earth flux lines that may be anomalous. The other is Aurora Borealis study. We'd love to see the evidence of global warming in this area. What kind of chemicals gather at the poles that we pump into our atmosphere? What kind of damage is being done to the planet? There are numerous areas that will be absolutely groundbreaking for this expedition.
Do you, now this is really left field, but I like to ask these questions, Brooks. What do you think about, and I've had some different people, there was a man who actually survived going through the triangle, Bermuda Triangle. What do you feel or think about that or know about that?
What has been represented to us is that there is some kind of dimensional gateway that the, I'm not going to say the uninitiated, I'm going to say the unworthy, are not able to open. You'll simply walk right through it like you're walking through a Walmart, and you won't see anything but whales and ice. But if you prepare yourselves, the consciousness of the venture is high enough. There are no dark hearts in it, harboring secret designs or whatever. Mm-hmm. Then the gate, allegedly, according to this legend, will be opened for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll be able to not only see and visit, but hopefully be able to return. It would just be a darn shame to lose a ship this size with 250 fine people on it, never to return.
Right, right. But I guess what I was asking is, there seems to be a lot of mysterious things. There's certain places on the planet. Some people would just say it's natural phenomena. But there was a fellow I interviewed who actually drove his plane through Bermuda, the triangle, with his father and another man. And it was like a magnetic cloud, as he described it, that followed him and actually collapsed in on him as they were leaving. And he was able to travel a distance of 90 miles to Miami within 10 seconds. And he figured he had to be going several thousand miles an hour at that point. Now, to me, that seems like an unusual anomaly, but I guess what I'm getting at is, could this be a doorway of some sort? I've heard that it was maybe a potential doorway to the inner earth.
Well, one of the things that Tesla talked about is that when you concentrate an electromagnetic field and in specific frequencies, and he was talking down around 10.8 to 15 hertz, that you open these dimensional gateways. The movie The Prestige kind of played a little bit with that that idea in the film. The Earth, in this particular area, acts like a giant magnet, and you're at the north end of the bar. And this is where all the flux lines of the planet either enter or leave, depending on how you look at the way magnetic flux moves. So this is the perfect magnetic lens to be able to open something just like that, like an Einstein-Rosen bridge, except it goes through the planet. Maybe it goes through dimensions.
Mm. Boy, that's cool. That's a cool thought, thinking about that, huh? That there could be other dimensions within that we could be traveling to. You had talked earlier, and I just wanted to touch on this again, and wondered how you came to this point of belief. Unless it's just awareness that you knew this your whole life, but you said earlier that you were here the first time, and others have been here other times before. Now, how do you know that? How do you feel that?
That's a good question. I wrote a book a couple years ago called Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. And in that book, I recount this place that I began going in my meditation back in 2006, and I've been going ever since. And it's as real as my neighborhood here, except that I was in a different type of body, and the surroundings, of course, were quite different. My neighbors and the village and the view of the sky and everything was different. And I remember very clearly just the profound, not sadness, just regret, because anytime somebody dies or passes away and then comes back, the first thing that they recount is this profound regret that they left things unfinished, that they, you know, were harsh to a person, you know, right before they left and they didn't mean to be, or they left a question unanswered with someone. And that's the way I felt. I walked out on my beautiful terrace, which overlooked the ocean in this world that where I lived, and I woke up in the body of a 9-year-old boy. So I didn't fit here. And not that I have a longing to go back, but I have a longing to remember. Right. And if I existed there, then I existed other places as well. And what I notice when I come here, almost immediately now, I can meet them, people who are their spirits, the animated part that makes up the inside of their body, their personality, their drive, their desire, comes from somewhere else, comes from another world to here. And you can see them, I can see them anyway, and I recognize it right away. I can also recognize the ones that are from here, or they've reincarnated here many, many, many times, and they're so locked into the pattern of this planet they can't escape. You ask me, how is it that we forget? Well, you got to remember, when we come here, we don't come here as adults. We come here as a fetus, and as soon as we spew the amniotic fluid out of our lungs and our nose, we have to wrestle. We're a beautiful, animated, intelligent being that's timeless. We have to wrestle with the inabilities of this new infant body. It can't speak. It can't understand anything anyone says. It can't even control its own bowel movements. And by the time we learn to speak and reason and think, we're so indoctrinated that we are a human that we've forgotten who we are.
And you do see cases of kids that are, you know, if they're not controlled like that, indoctrinated, they remember things, previous lifetimes, or just other things in general. You know, they know them. And then there's a good example of a woman. She's from Louisiana. I interviewed her, and she was telling me her granddaughter, she doesn't drink much. She said they were at a family function, and her granddaughter saw her drinking a wine cooler, half a wine cooler. And the granddaughter comes running over to her and says, "What are you doing, Grandma? Stop that." And she looks at her and goes, "What? That's how you died in your last lifetime. Stop doing that." And years later, the young girl didn't remember that. Of course, the grandmother still did. But isn't that something? At that age, it's still very clear if we just could speak it, because, you know, we still have the memory. It's fresh. And then others will say, "Well, that doesn't exist. That's not real. You can't believe that. You don't fit in. Stop doing that." We don't maybe have scientific proof to back that up. But you know somewhere within. This is what I find amazing about you, Dr. Agnew. You are very scientific, obviously, in the way you approach things. But I also find there's a spiritual side to you, a deeper metaphysical spiritual side to you that combines the two. And that seems a little unusual.
Well, I appreciate that. Actually, I think that they're integral, because the statistics that we end up with a carbon-based universe, that stars put off nitrogen and oxygen, silicone, and any other possibility, are pretty clear. The mathematics that allows a planet, a universe like this to occur, are probably spiritual. But the fact that the pattern exists means that only this kind of universe could exist. And so I think I have resolved that the scientific method or the scientific outlook that I have on life and spiritual existence are one and the same. Mm. It's only humans that have separated them, separation of church and state. You remember, centuries ago, science and religion were one, and it's only because the religious part, and believe me, we still have it, not just in churches, we also have it in science. We have our high priests that either approve or disapprove of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Once people begin to inject their ego, or their egos become inviolate on this, on the proof or disproof of any idea, well, then you're going to have suppression, and you're going to have all kinds of discriminatory activities that go on, and that's where I think the crime has been. Most of the really intelligent mathematicians that I know, and the ones even that I've read about, have had, I'm going to say, higher personal spiritual experiences.
Mm.
They've actually been handed pure mathematics in dreams, in meditations, in visions. They didn't understand them because they're not derivations. That is to say, you're not using a previous math formula to derive a new one. You're not combining existing math to create something. It's whole mathematics, whole concepts dumped into their head. It's because science is the spirituality. And whether we have the aptitude or intellect to understand that or not is irrelevant. It is true.
That's amazing. That's really cool. And it's nice to meet somebody with that perception of it, because I guess I don't know too many scientists. I've talked to a few on my show, but usually they don't expand like you did. So I really appreciate the fact that you're willing to share that. I don't know if you get ridicule over that at all, over some of the experiences you've had. Have you ever received that?
No, not really. Most of my colleagues, you know, respect where I come from and my approach, and whether we're talking about Michio Kaku or Mohammed Goswami or Ed Close, these are other, you know, prominent published physicists out there, much more public than I am. But we not only share ideas and idealisms, but we actually bounce ideas off each other. And I remember when Ed Close wrote his first book, Transcendental Physics, and he, you know, didn't corroborate with me, interviewed with me after he wrote the book, but there were some unanswered questions in his books, which we answered on the program. And he promptly went back and wrote another book, which was even more beautiful and more fantastic than his first one.
So always willing to learn and expand on it. That's awesome. And I hope you have a great journey in 2013, July, leaving Murmansk, Russia. And your website, once again, Dr. Agnew, is what?
It's nippy.org, North Pole Inner Earth Expedition.org. You can put in all that into Google or Nippy. You'll find it. It's easy to find. It's out there.
Now, how long do people have to try to sign up to be a part of this?
I would say about 4 months. They can sign up between now and Christmas, and that will pretty much end the database. Like I said, the odds are much better if you believe you're that right person and you've got the passion to put into your into the little message window of the form that's there under contact us at nippy.org. You'll show up. Believe me, somebody knows who the right people are that are supposed to be on this venture. And if you feel you're one of those people, don't think that lack of money or education is a disqualifier either.
Okay. Well, I really thank you for your time, and I will get a hold of you down the road a little bit, and if we can talk to you during the expedition and you have some free time, I would love to do that as well.
Well, I think we can make that happen.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much for the interview.
Music on Out There, created by Kevin MacLeod.